This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments Podcast for the week of December the 1st, 2014. This podcast is brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated for your personal use. Any other use of this podcast audio without the written consent of your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated is prohibited. This podcast is copyright 2014 by Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated. I'm Ed Zollers. I'm back on the North American continent this week after being in Guam last week, and I will be doing this week's update for federal tax developments that have taken place over the past week, and it's been a rather short week since we're looking at the Thanksgiving holidays that were going on here. But we'll take a look at what's come down this particular week. First, Revenue Procedure 2014-62 was issued on the 21st of November, and that particular ruling puts out new percentages for 2016 that deal with the Affordable Care Act, specifically dealing with the percentages that will be used for determining affordability of insurance and qualifications for the credit under Section 36B of the Code. These are inflation-adjusted, issued annually. The 2015 numbers came out earlier in the year, so you have to go back and look for those. We now know the 16 numbers. The notice also provides numbers that deal with affordability from the Health and Human Services Department, but it notes that those 2016 numbers are still preliminary, and the IRS will adopt those once Health and Human Services make it final. But that notice is out right now, so again, that's Revenue Procedure 2014-62. The IRS also issued Notice 2014-74. This one was issued on the 24th of this week. And this is interesting because this is where the IRS every so often goes out and issues the safe harbor notices to be given to participants in a employer's qualified plan when the employee receives a distribution from the plan that is a qualified rollover distribution. Under Section 402 of the Code, the plan is required to give certain information to individuals when they receive a qualified rollover distribution. The plan fulfills that requirement by issuing a notice, and the IRS issues these safe harbor notices that plans can use to basically satisfy the requirements. The document makes it very clear that you can modify these as appropriate and should modify them as appropriate for your plan. If something's inapplicable, you pull it out. But you can use these documents. This is the first time we've updated this since 2009, and it incorporates changes in the law since September 28th of 2009. If you work with a client who has a qualified plan, or you work with qualified plans, clearly you want to start using these notices instead of the old boilerplate for notices to employees from this point forward. What this incorporates is additional information about in-plan Roth rollovers, because that has changed since 2009. We had the 2012 expansion of in-plan Roth rollovers. Also, it incorporates the notice we discussed a couple of weeks ago that changes the way you can handle if you have pre- and post-tax contributions into the plan, deals with the way you can handle that in rollovers. These notices incorporate that new notice. That new notice technically doesn't need to apply until 2015 distributions, but you can elect to apply it early. If you do, these are the notices you will use. As always, the IRS cautions if the law changes, and in this case, the lockdown date is December 8th of 2014, any law changes after December 8th of 2014, a plan administrator will need to modify these documents to the extent it would be relevant to keep them as being qualified for giving the proper notice. But certainly they will serve as a good starting point, and until such time as Congress actually passes a new law that impacts plans, they basically will give you coverage under the safe harbor. So again, if you have not already done so and you work with plans, you want to go grab Notice 2014-74 from the IRS website or from your tax service, and get the new language incorporated into your notices to the employees. The IRS also issued Revenue Procedure 2014-12. This is a rather involved notice, but it deals with an issue that's arisen since the IRS win back in 2012 in the case of the historic Boardwalk Hall LLC versus Commissioner case. If you remember that case, that was a case where a partnership had essentially issued partnership interests, and the main characteristic of those interests were that the partners buying in received tax credits, rehabilitation tax credits under federal law. The tax court had originally held that that was okay, that that was still a valid partnership interest. The IRS argued these people weren't really partners because in participate, they were protected. They had very little interest. They really had no easy way to share any appreciation, income, or loss from the partnership. They were protected both ways. So they got their tax credits, but they really weren't the equity holders the IRS claim was. The tax court had held that, well, that's not really a problem because Congress clearly intended for the credit to be done this way. Of course, that kind of echoes what some of you may remember from the old Virginia historic tax credit that was a state tax credit where the tax court made the same statement. And on appeal, the result for the tax court was the same as it was in the Virginia historic case. The Third Circuit, like the appeal from the Virginia case, the Third Circuit in this case held that, in fact, they were not partners, and it basically got rid of the partnership structure. Now, that's wonderful, except obviously it threw into question how much equity interest must a partner have in a rehabilitation partnership in order to be able to obtain the credits and have them allocated to them. The IRS, in this revenue procedure, has issued a brand new ruling to hopefully let us know, or basically to give us a safe harbor. This safe harbor imposes various requirements. If you are involved in setting these up, you certainly want to take a look at Revenue Procedure 2014-12 for doing so. A very rough summary. The requirements are going to require principals, that is, those who manage the entity, to have at least a 1% interest in the entity. It's also going to require various things about investors. Investors will have to put up at least a fifth of their money up front, whatever they're supposed to put into this. The investors must also have a bona fide interest that has no special arrangement that reduces the value of their interest, that is, so that they don't participate in anything except the credits. We also cannot have any value, any other arrangements that would protect them, that gives guarantees to them except for specified guarantees. So the promoter cannot essentially assure that they'll get this preferred return, but nothing more, so that we know how that works. That won't work for that standpoint. Also, we have to have certain issues with regard to, we cannot borrow money from the promoter to get into this, and we can't have certain rights for puts and calls that would allow you to sidestep and basically remove their interest in the entity. Anytime we deal with an agreement that deals with fair value of the partnership, the fair value can only consider agreements that are okay on the basic structure here. So we have that. So if we have some sort of fair value purchase agreement down the line, reality is it's got to tie to only consider the items that are allowed under the general IRS rule in the partnership. This credit must be allocated in accordance with provisions of Section 704B, which specifically it deals with the regulation 1.704-1B4II, which is the part of the regs under partnerships that deal with what will be respected as an allocation of credits. So we have to do it under that structure. Generally, you've got to allocate credits to the people that would get the income or loss from the activity in question. Therefore, you've got to make sure it follows in a similar fashion. You probably, from this standpoint, remember, this is a safe harbor. So the good news about this is if you don't meet the safe harbor, that doesn't mean you haven't got something that works under the law. But the bad news is agents have historically read safe harbors such as this as being absolute litmus tests. That is, if you do not meet the safe harbor, agents are very likely to go ahead and treat the individuals who purchased interests that get allocated the credits as not partners and attempt to assert historic boardwalk. So for pragmatic purposes, most entities will probably want to structure themselves to come into line with the safe harbor under these rules. Again, that is Revenue Procedure 2014-12. So if you deal with this, you want to make sure you've taken a look at that particular issue. Next, we move on to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals case of Long versus Commissioner. Cited as 114 American Federal Tax Reporters 2nd, paragraph 2014-5446, it reversed Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2013-233 that was issued last October. In this case, it was an interesting question about whether the income Mr. Long had from a $5.75 million payment he received was capital gain or ordinary income. Mr. Long had been involved in a potential attempt to create a condominium and purchase land to build a condominium on. He was going to be involved in developing that. The situation gets rather complicated. If you read the case, you're going to find out all kinds of neat facts going on. But at a certain point, what happened was this. He had a contract with a party under which he could acquire the land. The party to that contract later backed out. Mr. Long sued. State court ordered that other party to go forward with the sale of the piece of land. The other party then filed an appeal. At the time the appeal was filed, Mr. Long then sold his rights in that particular lawsuit, which would mean the rights, if you win it, to develop the property, to a third party for $5.75 million. The IRS argued that $5.75 million amount represented ordinary income to Mr. Long, because it said since he was going to purchase the land and basically develop it, and they ruled that he was going to be in a development type structure, that therefore that should be replacement of ordinary income, and the $5.75 million should be ordinary income. The tax court agreed with the IRS, but the 11th Circuit did not. In the 11th Circuit's view, the issue of what he planned to do with the land became irrelevant because, as the court argued, he never owned the land. All he did was sold the rights to a lawsuit. That right, contractual right to a lawsuit, therefore the right to establish a business, was considered to be a capital asset in the view of the 11th Circuit. As such, he had capital gain on the $5.75 million. Now, the IRS attempted to basically recover somewhat by arguing that, well, if he had it, it should be a short-term capital gain, because what ended up happening was after he had the court award, then the filing was made in the Court of Appeals. And he only held that for a short period of time, therefore it should be a short-term capital gain if it is a capital gain. The 11th Circuit disagreed with that. The 11th Circuit said if we're just going to follow the lawsuit, we go back to the original filing at the trial court level, which was more than a year before. And that's the point at which these rights became in question. But secondly, they said, and he should probably saw the right to even go back to when he got the contract to purchase the land, because that was the time at which these rights, which are now in dispute, were basically established. So it was a $5.75 million long-term capital gain. Now, Mr. Long appealed a couple of other decisions that went against him in the tax court on this case. Unfortunately for Mr. Long, his winning streak stopped at the one issue, but it was the big one in the case. So in this case, the 11th Circuit held that, in fact, this was a case of not a substitute for ordinary income, but rather sale of an asset. What this indicates to us is this is always a messy and somewhat complex area to find that neat dividing line between the sale of a capital asset and the replacement of ordinary income. Next, let's move on to Technical Advice Memorandum 2014-48032. In this particular case, this TAM looks at an issue that arose for a private foundation. A private operating foundation, just a private foundation in this case, ended up having an issue that arose for it, because what ended up having was it went ahead. One of the taxes that's imposed on a private operating foundation is that it could be imposed with a tax if it has excess business holdings under Section 4943. Excess business holdings amounts to generally holdings that are greater than 20% in a business enterprise after reducing those holdings by any shares held by disqualified persons. That's a broad definition of a related party to the private foundation. The foundation in question had hired a tax preparer to help them work out this number, because it's a rather complex situation, complex area of law. The preparer had prepared a memorandum that discussed the fact of whether or not the entity had holdings that were in excess or could become in excess. And what the preparer decided was the answer was no currently, and also decided that generally they would not be required to reduce them in the future. The problem turned out that the preparer's answer was wrong, at least for the future of dispositions. So at the time the preparer issued his memo, there was not a violation, but a violation was coming down the pike. Unfortunately, the preparer didn't notice that. And so basically, eventually, the next year, when it would be in violation, the preparer went back to that memo, decided again there was no trouble, and went ahead and prepared the 990 without worrying about the excess holdings for the private foundation, which would have triggered the initial 10% tax. A second year came along. This time, a new group of individuals were assigned by the preparation firm to handle this particular entity. And the new people went back and reviewed the memo and decided that, in fact, correctly, the memo was an error. And that, in fact, the private foundation had excess holdings going back to the prior year, plus, of course, the current year, neither one of which had yet been fixed. So now they were in 2 years of problems for this tax. The private foundation, therefore, went ahead and filed the tax return and requested a waiver based on reasonable cause and good faith. Under Section under basically section 4962, this 4943 tax can be waived if you can show reasonable cause and good faith. This got us to the TAM. As the TAM notes, in order to carry this, they have to show that the failure was due to reasonable cause, was not due to willful neglect, and the taxpayer corrected the problem within the applicable correction period. The IRS noted that nobody questioned the first two issues, or the last two issues, I should say. There was not willful neglect, and they had basically corrected it timely once they knew about the problem. They then analyzed whether there was reasonable cause, noting that even if you meet the other two, merely not being willfully basically failing to do it, you still have to have reasonable cause. In this case, the National Office concluded that they had reasonably relied on the information of the preparer. They had approached the preparer prior to the time that there was a problem. They had therefore exercised ordinary business care in attempting to ascertain their proper tax liability. They had given the preparer all necessary information, that this was not an issue they should have figured out on their own. There was no information in the letter that the preparer gave them back about this issue that suggested there might be a problem. And as soon as they knew there was a problem, they corrected the problem as soon as possible. Based on all those factors, the IRS held that, in fact, this taxpayer qualified for a waiver of this particular additional tax for both years. That worked out to be good news for the taxpayer. Even if you don't get involved in this particular area of private foundations, the concepts here of reasonable cause apply generally when taxpayers rely upon the advice of a professional advisor, even if that advice turns out to be wrong. So long as they basically sought the advice in a timely manner, they provided the professional with all necessary information, and there's no reason they should have been able to figure out that the preparer's advice were wrong, and they take corrective action once they know there's a problem with preparer's advice, generally that's going to qualify you. If the penalty qualifies for reasonable cause, that will qualify for the exception. A couple of things on the Affordable Care Act to close out here. First thing is, you may have heard, the final regulations got issued under 5000 Cap A on the Individual Shared Responsibility Plan. This is Treasury Decision 9705. This particular final regs deals with issues for cafeteria plans, so it talks about some issues there. Generally, that deals with how much of an employer's contribution can be counted in determining what the employee's required contribution is to a plan. And under the ruling here, if the employee cannot get the money back out in a taxable form, and it must be used for the medical care, it must be used for the medical insurance, can't be used for other purposes, that the employer's contribution there in a flex arrangement like that can be counted as a reduction of the required contribution of the employee. That can have implications for the employer in terms of the pay or play penalty. It also can have implications for the employee in terms of whether or not they can qualify for credits or whether they have unaffordable coverage. Health reimbursement arrangements, it pretty much finalized the rules there. HRA payments that can only be used for an integrated employer-sponsored plan, those go ahead and reduce the employer's contribution. Any other payments do not. That's key there. It therefore reiterated the problem we've had before with Notice 2013-54 that you cannot integrate with a plan that's on the exchange. This doesn't change the problem. It just reminds us that you cannot do that. It must be an employer-sponsored plan. And there are, and if you're not aware of the 2013-54 problems, that creates big problems for any employer who's attempting to use the exchange plans and then reimburse those. We've had that discussion before. Other issue that we had, we also went ahead and it gives some information about wellness programs. Wellness programs talks about qualified, non-qualified wellness programs. The one type of wellness program where the fact that if you complete it, you get a reduction in premium, that we are going to basically assume you do complete the program, is a wellness program based on smoking. Any other wellness programs, if there's a reduction in premium for completing it, we presume the employee will not complete that program in determining their required contribution. Okay. Finally, the final regulations dovetail into Notice 2014-76. The original proposed regulations had a list of automatic hardship exceptions. The IRS decided that regs weren't the place to put these because it could change over time. So they're taken out of the final regulations, and rather the IRS will issue notices. The notice this year for hardship exemptions that will be automatic is found at 2014-76 in the code. It lists a number of potential exemptions depending upon various circumstances. If you have clients who are looking to this, I suggest you take a look at that for determining what will happen and what hardship exemptions are available. This has been the tax update for the week of December 1st. It's now big time tax planning month. Go ahead, have an enjoyable time this week getting back from your Thanksgiving break. And we'll talk to you next week about the updates and changes that occur in the coming weeks.